The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
What is up, my fellow acts? Ralph Sutton, Big J Ogerson, Josh Adam Myers, and the legendary drummer of The Police, Stuart Copeland.
Oh, yeah. I forgot we did that.
We did it via Zoom. Mm-hmm. Both Jay and I are away, but it's a new episode. Hasn't aired yet.
Has not aired yet. Brand new. See if you could find the moment where you could tell Stuart Copeland, not that psyched to interact with me.
Yeah, by the way, I always like to play that game. Figure out where Jay punches out.
Well, first of all, let me say, without this, unlike, what were that? Is that Eve's? No, what were they? 311. Unlike 311, or the lead singer particularly, Nick.
Wow, you have a good memory.
Fuck yeah. With the exception of him, no one's ever, when I'm checking out, it's because I can see this show is not going to pick up a wave of funny.
Right.
At any point. The guy was...
I mean, he's a legend, and he's super nice.
Very nice. Nothing shitty about him at all. He was just ready to go. It was DMC-like in a lot of ways. DMC rules.
Yeah.
But he's ready to say the things he's going to say.
Yeah.
And he's going
to
say
He has his planned answers to questions that he knows are coming. And even if you don't ask the question that has his answer, he'll work that answer.
He's going to get it out. He wanted to add a lot of information. Very, very interesting. A fucking legend and one of the best drummers that ever existed.
Top 10, probably, of all time.
Oh, easily. Easily top 25, for sure. A lot of people say he's in the top 200.
Yeah, like this show.
Oh, my God. I bet he brags about it as much, too. I bet he finagles the numbers and then brags about it a bunch. Stuart Copeland fucking rules. So me and Josh, we're kind of with you, the audience, just checking this one out.
Yeah.
But we are there. If you watch, you'll see we're there.
You may not hear him, but Jay's there the whole time.
See if you can see how many times that me and Josh are looking down because we're privately typing to each other.
Yeah,
what are we doing here?
Can I give a little secret statement on this one?
I announce I'm gay.
No, at one point I say, I'm sure Jay or Josh has a question because I've been monopolizing
most
of your time. And then Jay texts me, I do not.
I don't.
But he is a goddamn legend, a super cool dude. If you're a police fan, you could have heard this 5 days early. Use the code SDR, gasdigitalnetwork.com, get 20% off. And here it is right now.
Stuart fucking Copeland, dude.
On the SDR show.
This is the intro to the shit show. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. This is a hit show. Show me a tit show. Please, someone fuck the hoe. It's weed, I beat, it's hookers and blow. It's art, you need to know. The SDR show. Let's go.
It is the SDR show. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll show. I am Ralph Sutton. With me, I'm not sure where he is. Where are you, Jay?
Timonium, Maryland.
It is Big J Ogerson. And then also joining us, because it's a big deal this week, Josh Adam Myers. Josh, where are you?
I am in Gramercy in New York City.
Oh, my apartment. We're neighbors now. I don't know why I forget that. How else can we say this? Other than we got another time we can say fucking rock and roll royalty. Ranked one of the best drummers of all time. I mean, not only a police career, but a career spanning decades as a composer in films and so many other things going on in his life. We are all thrilled to have him here. Calls himself Stu Daddy on YouTube as well as on the TikTok. It is Stuart Copeland. How are you, sir?
Very good, thanks.
That was a killer
intro. By the way,
intro.
It's Les Claypool who called me Stu Daddy. It's the only nickname I've ever had in my life, but I like it as I'm father of many.
So when did that nickname first come?
Are any of you, any of my children?
Maybe.
I got to check. There's so many.
How many do you have?
I got to tell you, my mom was a bit of a 80s whore, so it's possible.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm proud of you, my son. I adopt you. I hereby, you are my son.
Nice.
How long have you had the Stu Daddy acronym or moniker, rather?
Since the advent of Oysterhead.
Oh, when was that? I've never known that was.
No, I'm not even sure. 2000.
Mid-2000s, yeah.
Six, seven, something like that.
Okay, well, let's start with this. So you just, I mean, we all just saw the Taylor Hawkins tribute. It didn't happen that long ago. And you played there. And I read online that it was an emotional moment for you was backstage watching Shane play at the sound check. And that was like a wild moment for you. But my question before we get into it was that, is it true that you guys are indirectly and you specifically responsible for the Foo Fighters calling themselves the Foo Fighters because of Clark Kent being your acronym of a name years ago?
I'm not sure I follow the connection, but this is Dave's version of how he came about Foo Fighters. Mm-hmm. And I ain't going to dispute it. If he wants to give me any sliver of credit, I shall take it. Yes, I created the Foo Fighters. That's what Dave says. I don't think so. I think Dave completely gets all the blame.
But I mean, I guess because Clark Kent was some sort of alliteration, Foo Fighters alliteration. And
all right, okay. Well, Clark Kent, just so most of your leaders, your listeners probably wonder what we're talking about. Back when the Police was starving and we had recorded a couple tracks, there was a couple of police rejects. This thing just couldn't bring himself to sing my dumb lyrics. Mm-hmm. And so I did. I went into the studio by myself, played all the instruments, drums, guitar, bass, even sang. Now, I'm not a guy who even sings in the shower. I'd never been on the mic in any way, shape, or form. Anyhow, BBC One, Radio One, picked it up, and it became a little small hit out of nowhere. There we were struggling with the Police, trying to get something going. We were dead in the water, but Clark Kent gets a shot. And so I had this little flash in the pan. But the point from Dave's point of view, Dave Grohl, was that I played all the instruments myself and I had a secret identity. Right. Since the Police were nothing, I figured I'd had a, they thought it was Frank Zappa or something, but it wasn't. It was nobody. It was that dodgy drummer in the fake punk band.
Fair enough. And you said that you saw on stage that Shane already looks and plays kind of like his dad. Is that right?
Well, not just that. We were all there for a week in London rehearsing and hanging out. All these artists, and Lars Ulrich is now my best chuckle buddy, Roger Taylor, and we're all kind of there hanging out every night, with the occasional Beatle and Led Zeppelin wandering through the throng. Dang, that was a week of hanging with our peers, and amongst it all was little Shane, 15 years old, in everybody's face, in every dressing room, and chatting with everybody. It's like a little, totally like Taylor would have been, just all over hanging out with everybody. Dave and Taylor made fanboy cool. Even though he was stellar himself. So there's little Shane. They were like, what a cute kid. Wow, bright personality. They're going to have a tough time getting him through high school. and no idea. So the sound check at Wembley Stadium, which is this huge, when it's empty, it feels bigger when it's empty. Mm-hmm. And all the bands and all the artists are all doing their sound checks one after the other. And Shane gets up there just as I arrived. And they play that song of his. And oh my, to see him up there doing what his daddy did in the same kind of body language and I cry at dog food commercials. All right. so I got a little overwhelmed that I was sobbing and I embarrassed myself in front of, Chris Chaney, who was also sobbing.
And you said Taylor was always more of a fan. Like, he didn't realize how influential he was, which is kind of wild that he never.
Yeah, you go over, you go visit him and he wears your T-shirt.
That's cool.
I go over, he's wearing his Police T-shirt. When Neil Peart go over, he'd be wearing his Rush T-shirt.
That's so fucking cool, though.
Being that London was so perfect, and I mean, it was perfect. The way it was it didn't even feel like it was organized, and that was what was so special about it. It was just friends celebrating somebody's life. It just blows my mind, and I get why they're doing it in London, but not doing it in London, in Los Angeles. But that London one was so special.
It's gonna be hard to top that.
It was gorgeous.
It didn't just land like that. Dave put a lot of work into that. Dave is now officially the hardest working man in show business. He curated that show because he mixed the match. It was a unique show. It's the biggest, most impactful event I've ever had anything to do with. It was like Woodstock rolled into 6 hours with bands, with different singers with different bands, mixing and matching all the stuff. The curation of that show by Dave was made it made it what it was. It was 6 hours that did, I can't do 6 hours of anything. Rage Against the Machine, my favorite band. I can do like, you know, four songs and I get it. You know, home is my bedtime. But that was 6 hours that did not let up. And the, you know, the climax was Shane on the drums, followed by Dave singing a sad song solo.
That was hard to watch. God damn, that was hard to watch.
The energy in that stadium did not let up for 6 hours. It built up and built up and built up until the Shane moment.
With all the current documentaries, you probably shouldn't compare anything to Woodstock now. Woodstock almost sounds like it's going to become like a negative event in our history at some point.
Well, the original Woodstock was also a disaster. This was there was nobody starved. Nobody had a mud bath. Nobody. It was just the Wembley. And also, by the way, the Foo Fighters are the most hospitable band. Them, the Rolling Stones and U2 give the best backstage.
Oh, that's nice.
They take care of their guests really well.
Up until now, I thought it was Jay's mom that gave the best backstage.
Yeah, I mean, we're all there in this 5-star hotel with a suite. You know, my suite had an office, 2 dressing rooms, living room, bathrooms. Jesus. You know, they take care of their folks. The food.
That's how low rent I am. I was like, what do they got? Like bags of Cheez-Its and stuff.
Well, you got to hang out with the Foo Fighters more because they'll take good care of you.
With Ginger Baker, Neil Peart, Charlie Watts, Taylor Hawkins, all gone in like I don't know a year and a half, whatever it is. Are you looking?
I've been writing
ways?
A lot of obituaries.
Yeah. Are you looking both ways before you cross the street right now, just to be safe?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Neil. Well, okay. Charlie was ancient. He lived. You know, that's what happens when you get that old, I guess. I mean, you know, and Neil saw his train coming. He was diagnosed, and a couple of years. He was like, at one point, he said, "I'm a year past my sell-by date." And then he lived for another year. Mm-hmm. So he was at peace. Everyone, you know, his whole world, it was all, you know, with Taylor out of the blue, unexpected, not supposed to.
No, for sure.
Not supposed to happen.
I never got to meet him, unfortunately. Jay, did you ever meet him or no?
No. Huh. I like to think that you're going to live forever because Sting taught you all guys how to hold your semen in. That probably buys you 30, 40 years.
Now, past rock star. I will not countenance any of this. But, you're referring to the 4 hours of tantric sex, but you're forgetting, as Sting reminded me, that does include dinner and a movie.
and a very long movie at that as well.
It's The Irishman.
I also like the term that I heard you. I don't know if it's one that you coined or not, but you say drummers have a different like camaraderie. You use the term brothers of the stick, where singers, guitarists, they kind of compete with each other, but drummers seem to form like a brotherhood. Is that a fair assessment?
I it's stereotyping, but and reductionist, of course. But hey,
that's what I'm.
Let's go
for.
There. Yeah. It's true. Guitarists are all jealous of each other. Singers. They actually kind of have a bit of a thing, you know, and songwriters, they sort of have a secret cabal that drummers are not privy to. And this is only a suspicion because I'm a drummer. But drummers and bass players get of my top 10 chuckle buddies, I'd say 8 out of 10 are bass players or drummers. And drummer, because when you're banging stuff, you love to hear other banging going on because it kind of makes the whole rhythm richer and fuller and more fun. And we know our value to society, which is paramount. We're confident in that knowledge, so we're not so competitive.
You know, it's also, by the way,
has there ever been like a rhythm section beefs between band to band? I mean, there's been a lot of lead singer
and guitar.
Nikki
Sixx has had beefs with bands, and he's a bass player.
Come on, let's hear the dirt. What's
didn't
problem?
He just say recently? Didn't he just go? He goes Pearl Jam.
Yeah, he hated Pearl Jam. He said Pearl Jam. I don't get it. That was what he said.
Come on, what's the hate?
I have no idea. I did see that recently.
That was his big thing. He's like, yeah, not my thing.
That's stupid. That's a weird thing.
Actually, no. In fairness to Nikki Sixx, I believe that was a response to Pearl Jam saying. The reason they did their music was they didn't grow up listening to like Motley Crue and stuff. Like, I think it was that. I think he was saying like that wasn't our thing. Like that was for the girls or something.
So silly.
No, that's my point though. I'm saying like I've never heard of like a drummer, like two drummers just happen to hate each other.
Well, you know, Ginger Baker was not easy company.
Oh, yeah.
But he liked other drummers. Yeah. I got along. He and other drummers, even Ginger Baker, you know, beware Mr. Baker. even he got along well with his brothers of the stick. Mind you, they're all groveling at his feet, you know. Yeah. That makes it easy to get along.
Is that a term you coined, or is that a common term amongst drummers?
I'm the first person I know of using it.
Nice.
What's also
Foo Fighters, Brothers of the Stick. This is gonna be great.
Hey, did all those.
Responsible for so much culture.
Can you give Josh a nickname while you're here?
Josh Freese, yes. Oh, we got another Josh?
That I'm Josh. But, yeah. But
Josh, all right, okay.
But I could, I'm honored to be, mistaken for Josh Freese. He's one of my favorite drummers. He did my podcast and I saw him play with Devo, and he took Devo, which, you know, I never would imagine would have been like a hard punk band live. And it's just added such a full sound. And he looks like, and same with you, you guys look like you're having the most amount of fun playing your instrument. And it's just,
well, he does make it look easy.
Yeah.
And also he's a hardened session guy. If you want meat and potatoes, he can do meat and potatoes. If it's Devo, he'll come up with the weird stuff that Devo requires. And, you know, on the night, Lars Ulrich, Roger Taylor, Josh Freese, Omar Hakim, everybody was on their A game. You betcha. You know, we're all friends and stuff, but everybody was on their A game.
That's wild.
Josh has got some chops on that kid.
He's the best.
I'm the one here that generally does the research, because these guys are comedians and much funnier than I by leaps and bounds. And then I always look into people and I find out things that are like, holy shit, I can't believe that's true. So I have to ask you these things, and I could be wrong, but your father, who was originally in the, was like one of the founding members of the CIA. Is that actually accurate?
Yes. He was one of the first people in the newly formed CIA that derived from OSS, which is the Wartime Intelligence Service. And then when we went into the Cold War, this division was adapted for the Cold War, basically against the Ruskies, the Soviets. And it was, we're the two great empires, the First World and the Second World, were arguing over the resources in the Third World. And America had all these systems, and we had our despots, dictators, and dickheads that we were propping up. And so did the Ruskies. And my daddy's was in the Middle East.
And you moved out there.
All got resolved with Rocky IV, no?
I beg your pardon?
Didn't it all get resolved with Rocky IV?
I never saw that movie, but I would be relieved to find out if that were so.
Don't you dare! Have you never turned your television Rocky on a Saturday 4? Or Sunday?
If you turn your TV, I lost track of which Rocky was which. To tell you the honest truth,
that's fair enough. But it's so you left the country at like a very young age and didn't come back till you're 18, right?
Yeah, when I was born in Alexandria, Virginia, McLean, which is, by the way, is a suburb of the CIA. My daddy was away on business. He was busy installing a dictator in Egypt named Gamal Abdel Nasser. But as soon as I was old enough to travel, about two months, they shipped me back over to Cairo with and the rest of the family. And so we were in Cairo, Egypt, until maybe I was 7 or 8. Then we moved to Beirut, Lebanon, until I was a teenager, and went from there to boarding school in darkest Somerset, England. Then finally didn't get to the land of my birth, my home country, until I was in college.
That's crazy.
But all that time I was the American kid. So I'm probably more patriotic than most Americans who are just another kid.
Did you like unlearn accents at any point? Because those formative years, you must have had local accents on some of these places. Yeah.
Well, not just accents. I had to unlearn words. I didn't realize when I got to England that half the words in my vocabulary were not in the English language. They were Arabic words.
That's wild.
All of the expats, all the Diplo brats of Beirut, which was a den of intrigue. It was the spy capital of the Middle East. We all spoke kind of an Araba franglais, which is a mix of Arabic, French, and English. And as kids, I didn't know which words were in which language. We just sort of, they were interchangeable. And so I got to England and had to unlearn all that Arabic. And by the way, a few years ago, I went to Morocco and found that I understood the people and that phrases would come out of my mouth without me even thinking. And I'm terrible with languages. I go to Italy every summer. I've been trying to learn Italian. Not going to happen.
You were Jason Bourne-ing it. That's pretty cool. It just came instinctually. That's pretty awesome.
Just came right out of my mouth, you know. So memory is a weird thing.
That's so cool. And then it's so weird because you are like an American overseas till you're 18 and you're like very staunchly American. The Police, you're the only American guy in the band. It's much more looked at as an English band. Did you fight for your like understanding that, hey, I'm American. Like, it's not just an English band. I'm in this band too. Or you give up on that at some point. I don't know.
Well, I thought I was American until I got to California. And all my surfer buddy friends, and you know, in Point Loma, San Diego, where at my college, it was basically the surf college. They thought I was full on English.
Oh, that's so funny! Yeah, even now,
you know,
I mean,
there was like, trying desperately to be American, but didn't fool any real Americans until I went back to England. Of course, they all think I'm super Yank. You know, as they call septic tanks, rhymes with Yank, but. And, you know, people hear me speak, as you say, Police is supposed to be an English band. And I open my mouth and then people look a little disappointed. Really? You know, it's sort of like Ringo Starr from New Jersey or something, you know, it's kind of a letdown.
You got to go, all right, guys, fair enough. I'm not English. I'm from Beirut.
Also, your brothers, all of you were somewhat in the music industry. One of your brothers managed the band for a long time. Another brother who I think passed away was like an agent. Like, you all kind of worked in the music industry. And I think your first band was with one of your brothers called the Black Knight. So like, you're all kind of in that world.
Yep. My two brothers were two music industry moguls. My brother Miles and my brother Ian were pretty much responsible for the early 80s British invasion, all the new wave bands. You know, all the bands that Ian represented, all of them, and Miles had many of them on IRS's record label with the Americans, the Go-Go's, the Bangles, REM, Wall of Voodoo, Oingo Boingo. And that was kind of the biggest of the independent labels. Mm-hmm. And so there are two very important characters. Sadly, one of them passed away.
Right.
And my brother Miles has retired to his castle in France.
Yeah, you guys don't have the most amicable relationship these days. Am I right with that? I think so.
I get along. Well, I love my brother. He doesn't love me so much because he didn't manage the Police tour. He's, you know, he does bear grudges. but hey, I got no problem.
All right.
Before we go any further, Jay, you're a car guy all day long.
Dude, have you always been a car guy?
Oh, yeah, dude. Born a grease monkey. people, I was born with one of those wrenches under my hand. Whatever those wrenches use for car stuff.
No, you really sound like you know what you're talking about.
Is that an Allen wrench?
No, I don't think so.
Probably not.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, dude, I'm all about carburetors and spoilers.
Fuel injection.
Totally. Fuel injection is my major, and I minored in disc brakes.
Okay, fair enough. Well, if you have someone like Jay in your life, a car guy, you want to head him on over to rockauto.com.
I'm building a Chevy fucking car. In my yard right now.
Is that the model?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, we'll see when I'm done what it is.
Do you? You know you have a Chevy base.
Yeah, listen. Here's what I know. The guts, Chevy.
Oh, Chevy all day long.
I don't know what's going to be going on with the outside. A lot of spoilers, though.
If you head over to rockauto.com, they have every single part you could possibly need. That's why Jay Chevy could be anything.
Oh, well, the prices are so cheap. I might halfway decide making it into a Cadillac Escalade.
Yeah, why not?
Or I might just keep it as like a Chevy Nova.
Or maybe flip it into a motorcycle.
I don't even know. I have so much fun buying parts. I get stoned. I order away. And then I send back what I don't need.
It's like the Amazon of auto parts. You don't even know what you got. It shows up a few days later. It's like, oh, yeah, I ordered this.
Listen, we know right now the car market is hot. You know, those chips, they're not there anymore. So the new cars aren't coming out. So if you got an old car, it's fucking a good time to keep that shit running right and keep it well maintained. It feels good to know you're driving a reliable car, and rockauto.com makes it easy with every part you need at the lowest prices. Guess what? They don't even have a promo code. All we ask is that you go check them out and let them know that we sent you. There's a little box where you can put in the show's name.
Bless you.
Sorry, I'm such a dude.
That happens when you work on cars.
Ralph, to be fair, hand me a 3/8 wrench.
Well, is that a thing you think?
That's a half wrench, you ass. 3/8. God, what a dumbass.
I wonder if that's a thing.
I thought you said 3/8 wrench.
3/8. It's a fraction.
I still don't think it's a thing.
3/8 wrench?
Yeah, I don't know if it is. Is
Shannon, look up right now. 3/8 wrench.
Maybe. I don't know if it's a
thing. Dude, it's a ratchet set.
But is that a wrench?
Yeah. Ratchet.
3/8 wrench.
Boom.
All right, there you go.
That's you feel like a stupid. And by the way, that works
for
all car
parts. That looks exactly like you'd think that you'd work on.
Absolutely, dude. I'm a grease monkey. You've been known that. RockAuto.com. Make sure you tell them that we sent you. And
get,
get
a 3/8 wrench while you're there.
You know what, while you're there? 3/8 wrench it. You'll find a reason to use it.
Get one for the whole office.
RockAuto.com, everybody. All right, let's get back into it.
So going to the police, I don't know, a lot of interesting stories and things about the police because it's such a legendary band. But I think it was you that said this years ago, that there was a time where it was very democratic in the police. Everybody brought their own songs in and those would get recorded. But at some point along the way, it started to just gravitate towards Sting. And I think the line that really made me laugh was at one point he had like a little delusion where he thought it was the devil, Sting, something along those lines. But that was true in the beginning. It was like, hey, we all bring our own songs in and we record everything.
No, when we started, it was all my songs.
Oh, okay.
Which were songs of convenience. I knew three chords on a guitar, had never listened to lyrics, and there am I writing lyrics. I had no idea. But I made these songs so that we could be a band. And when I hornswoggled Sting to move down to London from Newcastle, hey, I got a band, we got material, we got gigs. I didn't have any of those things. And so I had to scrabble together some so-called material, which I will be the first to admit was not of a great quality. But Sting kind of, he got the scene. We had a bond. We got along really well. And then he started, when Andy joined, who had much more chops, much more vocabulary on his instrument than Henry, that's when Sting kind of lit up and started writing songs. And the first song that I can recall that he brought in, I think was Born in the 50s. And the minute I heard that, let's do that. And that became my favorite song in the set. Mm-hmm. And then he came out with another one. Whoa, cool. Let's do that. And, song by song, I didn't see them as his songs and my song. I saw them as our songs, which were much better than we, every song was an upgrade. Mm-hmm. And so at first, Sting was very happy that we were interested in working on his songs. And, you know, he took a lot of input. But as we had hits with those songs, and as the confirmation that actually he is a pretty good little songwriter, and he does kind of know what he's doing when it comes to writing a hit, mm-hmm. he became less dependent and less malleable. And I have total sympathy for that position because to write material of that quality takes a singularity of purpose. He conceives the whole thing in his head, and anything that isn't that thing that he conceived is a compromise.
Right.
And so that was very tough for him because he is the person for whom musical truth is absolute and is above all other considerations. Now, from my point of view and Andy's point, it was not as much fun having to struggle to get a word in edgeways. And we now have laughed about it. And we understood what it was all about. It wasn't egos. It was just a matter of creative participation. But on the other hand, what we did not mind, what we did not have a problem with, was the quality of his songs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, we would, in the later years, we'd each go off and we'd write songs, because if we showed up in the studio without songs, Sting would be thinking, what, am I the only person doing homework here? Of course, yeah. He had no interest in playing our songs, just as long as we were working as hard as he was.
He puts it up on the fridge. Look how cute you guys are with your songs. I'm putting those over there.
Yeah. But really, when we were always waiting for him to pull out one of his killer songs.
That's wild. I mean, it's very public that by synchronicity, you guys were not getting along. He's even said that it was recorded in separate rooms. Like, it was, it's funny that the least synchronized you guys were was in synchronicity, which is a wild. But at what point?
Good one, Ralph.
Thank you. At what point along the five albums was it that you realized things were going awry? Was it recording synchronicity or was it happening before then?
No, it was the third album, Zenyatta Mondatta, which we recorded in Holland, where he started to feel the compromise thing was just eating away at him. He'd have it in perfect in his mind. And whatever we did to contribute to it was just a departure from his perfect vision. Then I kind of understand that. You know, I write music for orchestra where I put every detail on the page, and I love it when they obey the page, which is their whole ethos. And I totally understand that you create something that's perfect in your mind and that's what you want to hear. But in a band, it's about collaboration. And if you're in a band with the upside is you have great material to work with. The downside is that it's no fun working on it. And that started the third album, got more harsh the second album, the fourth, and then the fifth album was really very difficult. But we all recognized, in hindsight, certainly, that the result of that struggle was good stuff. Yeah. It wasn't any fun. It was a struggle. It was really emotional. But we're all very proud of the result. And by the way, this struggle was only in the band room. By the time we'd get to dinner, we were brothers again. We would laugh and sing and dance and play. It was only when we were trying to work music out that we would have these conflicts. And fortunately, at least Sting and I, we have a very shallow reservoir. And so try as we might, 20 minutes later, I'm struggling to hold on to that rage, but it's gone.
That's good. That's nice to hear that. So the wild thing to me is 83, you know, you guys are the biggest band in the world. You're playing Shea Stadium, all this crazy stuff, you know, and then the band is on hold. In my mind, that could be, you know, the band breaks up, a time where you would fall into a depression, but a phone call from Francis Ford Coppola changes your whole career trajectory. That is wild to me.
That was indeed a blessing, and you put it very well that, you know, except that the call from, that's a nice story. We can go with that. But the call from Francis actually came before the police broke up.
Too bad. It's much better than the way that I said it.
I had already discovered film composing as a new lifestyle and a new mission before. And in fact, I went from, it might have, either one of the albums that we recorded on Montserrat, and then we mixed it in Montreal, outside of Montreal. Mm-hmm. And I went straight from there to San Rafael and Napa County to working with Francis, where I'm alone in the studio playing all the instruments myself. And I'm working with Francis would come in and love everything. And I'm there without being judged, without having to fight for any corner, without having to negotiate, without anybody beating on me. You know, oh, it was just heaven. So already I knew that there were sunnier meadows beyond the police, which is why we were also amenable to killing the golden goose, to melting down the golden cage.
That's wild. And also, I mean, the amount of movies and TV shows, everything from Wall Street and, I mean, Highlander and tons of TV shows, it's and even video games. It's amazing. That's been a whole other career for you, for getting into the orchestra and other stuff in a minute. But composing of films and TV shows has become maybe one of your biggest successes as well. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it was the work is wonderful, but the business began to get to me. Working with a director to tell a story with music, it's fantastic without, you know, because nobody else on the team is a musician, mm-hmm. you know, producers, directors, actors, whatever. I'm the music guy. And so I didn't have to negotiate any musical issues. I would from the director, not a musician, saying, I just need it happier here. I can do that. He wouldn't come and say, I think that guitar should be a saxophone or you should play the hi-hat instead of the ride cymbal. None of that crap. Just the real stuff, which is, I need it happier here or sadder or darker or lighter. And then the musician figures out how to make that happen. But the best part of my 20 years before the mast as a hired gun, flinty eyed music for hire guy, was that it forced me to learn how to use orchestra. Mm-hmm. I had a forced education in orchestra, which is what I do now. I don't score films anymore. I'm out of that business, but I do work with orchestra, and that's really where life is at for me now. And I write this stuff at home. I put it all on the page and then I go out on stage and I bang shit while the orcs are doing exactly as told.
That's great. And also your mom kind of raised you on modern orchestra. Isn't that right?
Yeah. I was, my daddy raised me to be a jazz musician. And Stanley Clark, my buddy, tells me, dude, he raised you on wrong jazz, like white big band jazz, Stan Kenton, you know, wrong jazz. I'll give it up for that. But
it's
anyhow,
when
Miles came out, Miles Davis, I was busy with Jimi Hendrix, so I missed that whole thing. Meanwhile, my mother was listening to Stravinsky, 20th century composers, Ravel, Debussy, and that stuck emotionally. And so when I'd be walking down the street, I would have Stravinsky in one ear and blazing guitar drums in the other, Hendrix in the other ear. And sort of the music that I do with orchestra now is kind of that. I take the mighty Seattle Symphony, the Nashville or the Chicago Symphony, whatever, and I turn them into a humongous rock band.
You're doing the police arrange for orchestra. Go ahead, Jay. I'm sorry.
I was going to say it's very interesting within all that that you label your favorite band as Rage Against the Machine. That's very interesting.
I just love, that's how you do it. That is that I could watch Tim, Tom, and Brad all night. I don't care who they got at the front of the stage. Those three guys. That is how you do it.
Yeah, I give you credit.
We just went. Me and I went to two of the shows in New York. Josh here went to all five of them.
All five of them, and it was. It's just every night, like you said, it was just like you're never going to see a band that has. They're having so much fun, and
that's
and
so synergistic.
It really is. I actually wanted to ask you this question because since you've had this incredible career, I guess it's a two part question. Because I do a podcast where I'm going through Rolling Stone's 500 greatest albums, and we've already been through four of the Police records. Out of everything that you've done in the career,
man, which one didn't make the cut?
I'm trying. We've done Synchronicity, Outlandish Day of More, Zenyatta Mandata, and one more.
Ghost in the Machine, maybe.
Yes, Ghost in the Machine. But I'm curious.
Wow, the one that you missed out was Regatta, which is the best album we made.
Wait, well, I think Regatta's either coming up or we've already done it, or we've done all five. I just feel like every few months we're doing the Police, which is great because for me, it was like to really dig into your music. I mean, it was as a kid growing up, you only knew the hits, and then to really spend time with the record and see the you know, where you started with this reggae punk and it's kind of evolved. And then you get to Synchronicity, which is more what I thought was like what Sting was going to be doing with the rest of his career. Out of all his albums, which one are you the most proud of? Like of the work that you did with the band and yourself?
I think that the songs on Synchronicity, the lyrics, the songs that Sting wrote, Sting was he was still growing. With all the five albums, he continued to grow after the band. But for me, the most fun album was the second album, where we didn't have enough material. We were still codependent, and we were very much on a high from conquering America. We hadn't conquered America, but we were blazing our way across the land, playing show after show. We were where we would burn down the house. And, you know, we were just really full of ourselves, full of mojo. And so we went into the studio. You know, they say the old cliche is you have your whole life to write your first album and 6 months to write your second album.
Right.
Well, that's where we were. We didn't have enough material, so we had to make stuff up in the studio. And so it was just really collaborative, creative. And a lot of the material, like some tracks like Mosoko Tanga is like album filler. One of my favorite tracks we ever did. Regatta de Blanc is another instrumental thing that arose from a stage jam. Another of my, the stuff we made up on the spot was fun to make, and I'm very proud of it.
Hi there, responsible adults.
Hello.
Before we go any further, are you over the age of 21?
Buddy, I'm so far over the age of 21.
I thought there was going to be a follow-up to that.
Oh, I'm so far over the age of 21 that I've been able to vote since 2002 BC.
Do you remember what you were doing at the age of 21? We're talking about thousands of years ago.
Oh, dude, totally. I was looking at cave paintings.
Okay.
I was charming women with my vampire stuff that charms them.
And getting high with Delta 8.
And by the way, all day long, vapes. Ahead of their time. You don't even know that.
Cave,
Delta 8?
Cave painting vapes.
Oh, they had vapes. BC vapes. You see it in the wall drawings.
You have to really pay attention to the paintings.
Man, could Stuart Copeland be more bored with Jay and Josh? Take a hike, right?
Go to YoDelta.com.
Wrapped around your finger, but definitely not wrapped into conversation with us, right?
The message in the bottle is, hey, Jay, leave.
That poor Jay, he got a couple of eyebrow raises, and then I could almost see him in the Zoom. Turn to Ralph. How's that possible? We're not even in the same room.
It's two-dimensional.
It's two-dimensional. But he found where your box was, and he looked only at you.
Really was a point where that happened.
Yes.
Go to YoDelta.com. If you're over 21, living in a majority state.
That's cool, bro. I've always been a Neil Peart guy. Rush, the trio.
Go to YoDelta.com. Gummies and vapes.
All day long. It's weird
that the YoDelta Empire is taking the anger out where it's Jay.
Today's Tom Sawyer, me. Yeah, you don't fuck with Jay, dude. That guy's the heart and soul of this whole network. You better pray to God he stays alive and doesn't die at a Wu-Tang Clan concert.
Go to yodelta.com, yodelta.com.
Modern day warrior, me, bam, 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 bam.
Use the promo. Bam, 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 bam,
bam, bam, bam, bam, bam, bam, bam.
Promo code gas.
Ding, dong, dang, dong, dong. Ralph, do the bass part. Boom, dong, dig, dong, dong, dong. You suck.
I'm trying to give honor to Stuart Copeland.
Let's get back into it, dude. This guy is so done with me. Hey, if you need me, I'll be taking a shit you won't even notice.
Let's get back into it.
Was it true, again, I hear things I want to know, but true that when you were recording Synchronicity, Sting would delete your drum tracks and you'd have to come back in and record them? Is that actually true?
No. That's a true story, wrong album.
Oh, okay.
Later, years later, and I still to this day can't imagine why, we'd gone on our sabbatical, our forever sabbatical, two or three years into it, Sting calls around and says, hey, let's re-record some of our tracks. Okay. So we went in, we were all ready to go into the studio to re-record some of our songs. But I was playing a polo game, don't you know? And my horse did a somersault. I was obliged to dismount, landed on my shoulder, broke my collarbone, out of commission, couldn't play drums.
Wow.
And so I had my computer, my Fairlight computer, and Sting had his Synclavier computer, two competing brands of supercomputer, music computers. Nowadays, you can do it all on a Mac or on your iWatch. But then they had these dedicated, huge music computers. And so I had to program the drums. We only got as far as one track. And it was programmed. I wrote them. I had a sample of my snare drum, sample of my stuff, and I wrote the part. And Sting did some vocal arrangements, and everybody hated the result. It was Don't Stand So Close to Me, hated by all. Yeah. I kind of liked it. I thought there was some interesting stuff in there, but it was not a live band. It was synthesizer stuff. And the anecdote is that Sting preferred his Synclavier snare sample, store-bought, some fat, flabby backbeat crap. And I had my own drum, my sound of my snare drum as a sample, and I kind of preferred that. And I had this crazy idea that since it's my instrument, I get to choose which fucking sample we're using. And so I did. I did choose which fucking sample we're using until I left the studio for 10 minutes and Stigo would choose his fucking sample. And it went back and forth in that really constructive, collaborative way.
That's fucking hilarious. I saw that you said in your life, you've only done two drum solos. One was on David Letterman and the other one, which was batshit crazy, was in Africa in a chicken wire cage being attacked by lions.
Yes, that will bring the drum solo out in just about anybody.
First of all, how the fuck did you get out of it? Because I watched
why
it.
The fuck, you might ask.
Yeah.
Well, I was in Africa with a camera crew looking for the origins of American culture. Mm-hmm. And as you know, American culture is the most distinctive feature of American culture is our music. We have writers, but so does England. We have, painters, but so does everywhere else. Our music rules the world, and it is the most distinctive feature of American culture. Yeah. And that culture, I thought, came from Africa because it's our backbeat. It's the black aspects of our music that are our music. It's the backbeat and all these features of black culture that are the most salient features of our most salient cultural features. So I learned many years later, it didn't come from Africa, it came from New Orleans.
Okay.
It's American. It's black American culture. But I went to Africa to find the origins of this culture, and I found all kinds of interesting stuff. But not a backbeat and not a flattened seventh and not four on the floor and all these things that we think of as the American beat. But I did find all kinds of cool stuff. And along the way, my director, who wasn't interested in a documentary about important musical issues, he wanted to shoot an adventure movie. So we'd crossed Africa looking for weird, fun things to shoot. And he had, how about we put you in a cage with lions surrounded? Okay. So we go out to this ranch where there were the lions and they had this chicken wire cage and a drum set in it. And I was in there and had to insist that they put a top on this cage. And by the way, they had to festoon the cage with meat so that the lions could give a shit, And so the lions come up to the cage and they're all there. And the one thing I discovered is that they have very sensitive hearings. All I'd have to do is hit my snare drum and they'd run away. So I had to air drum and not actually hit anything until they started to get the taste of that meat and started to get a little argumentative amongst themselves, a little bit more aggressive, a little more frisky. And pretty soon I got nine lions crawling all over that chicken wire cage, and I'm playing a drum solo like the Ginger Baker. I'm playing Toad, you know, and just to stay alive.
How did they get the lions away? Because you were like surrounded. It was all four sides, it seemed. How did you finally get out?
By playing a lot of drums. And that's a good question, actually. How the hell I get out of that cage? They had retired by then. They'd kind of lost interest and moved back into the thing. And I was the cage was very close to the other 14-foot fence. By the way, they were over. This area was like divided by fencing. It was on a ranch, the Khashoggi Ranch, near Mount Kenya. And when they brought the meat truck in, the lions were up parallel to the running alongside the fence on the other side from the. And when it stopped, they were over that 14-foot fence, like, you know, no problem. But the handlers there, they kind of knew what they were doing and knew how to keep their both be aggressive and wave sticks and keep their distance at the same time. Mm-hmm. And like I say, all I had to do was bang a chrome snare drum, and that would keep them at bay.
That's funny. It's good to know. I mean, as you
and by the way, the look on those lions' faces reminded me of a certain bass player singer. He used to give me that look.
I want one more of the meat that I'm curious about. I know I'm sure Jay and Josh have a lot of other questions too, but what actually went down with the collaboration with you and the Ray and Robbie of the Doors? I know you recorded something, and then there was like it never came out. What actually was the ending result of Ray Manzarek, Robbie Krieger, and you?
Well, we never recorded anything. We did some shows, but really, I was the wrong guy. I am not a, you know, John Densmore is a trance guy. He gets into a groove, he holds that groove, and he just, you know, he builds momentum with it. And although I really couldn't believe that I am sitting in the room playing Strange Days with the Doors, with whom I grew up, I just couldn't believe I was in that situation. So I was very enamored of the situation. But it became pretty clear that I am not a trance guy. I am a frenzy guy. And I'm just banging too much shit. And I just was the wrong guy for the job. And so the atmosphere kind of soured. I mean, I tried to do Densmore, but I'm the wrong guy. And so we parted ways.
Okay. I don't know. I thought I said something weird. I could be wrong. But also, didn't you recently, I think you're the only rock drummer to win a Grammy for a new age album. Is that a fair assessment?
Thank you for bringing that up. It is a source of great pride. That box is now checked. I lead the world. And I just want to add a few wrinkles to that there, which is not just the first drummer, but technically, you know, I'm a punk rock drummer, you know. Okay, The Police was a fake punk rock band, but it was a punk rock band. And that makes me punk rock. And to win a new age Grammy, box checked.
And the album is Divine Tides with Ricky Kedge. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, it's actually not a bad album. And in fact, I think, you know, my idea of new age was the kind of music they play when you're getting a massage, you know. This would fuck up your massage. And I don't know how we scraped into that category, because there's all kinds of banging and clattering. It's got a little more energy than you would expect from something called new age. But the difficulty was, you know, the challenge was getting the nomination. Mm-hmm. Because of what I just said. But once we got the nomination, at that point it's voted on by the whole Academy and all the members, and it's a popularity contest.
Okay. And you're quite popular. One of my favorite little stories is that before The Police, you were in a band called Curved Air, and you wanted to get some notoriety for the band, so you wrote your own fake
the band
letters.
Are you kidding? Screw the band, I want a notoriety for my goddamn self.
Yeah, he would write letters to newspapers and stuff as different characters.
Yeah,
that just saw the drummer in Curved Air, and he was awesome.
Yeah, I just last night I had the exquisite pleasure of witnessing Curved Air and their new phenomenon drummer. And then the next day was, I saw Curved Air, they were fucking great. And then the next, and, you know, misspelled handwriting, you know, I had all different persona, different letterhead, different paper. And whenever we'd play a show in Nottingham or Liverpool or somewhere on the way out of town, unbeknownst to the rest of the band, by the way, I would drop these letters in the post box. And of course, this nefarious activity is a source of great pride and joy to me now in my latter years. I pulled myself up by my own bootstraps.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Also, I read various accounts of where the first police show was, but it was at CBGB's, wasn't it, or am I wrong?
No. First in America was CBGB's.
Okay. And where was the first
show ever was in Wales.
Oh, in Wales. Okay. I don't know why. So I guess I was sort of right. First in America.
Well, yeah, we were a London band. We played around in England. We supported Cherry Vanilla and others until we finally achieved headlining status, barely. But in America, we were all the way from London. So we headlined and we would show up in places like, Akron, Ohio, and the support act has got all the equipment, lights, everything all going on. And then the headliner, because we're from London, all the way from London, nobody had ever heard of us either, but we were all the way from London. We come on with two amps and a drum set. And often we were kind of outgunned by the support act. But we kicked their ass anyway.
Also, one of my favorite quotes of yours is, music is the key to sex. I like that.
I said that?
You did say that. Yeah.
Well, no, actually, let's put a little bit more of a dignified thing on that, which is that I can say this. I did a documentary for the BBC recently. What is music? What's it for? Why do we have music? Why do humans do music? Why is music the only form of art that will actually take control of your body and cause you involuntarily to wave your pudenda in public, thrusting overt sexual communication induced by music? Music does that too. You know, a play doesn't do that. Movies don't do that. Music will make you thrust your pudenda in public. Why is that? What is music for? And it turns out that indeed, I may have put it in rather crass language when I was a young man, but now as a studious
elder statesman
of music, I can say that actually procreation is a big part of what music is for.
All right. It's a much fancier way of putting it. Also, the police are releasing.
It gets you laid.
Yeah, there you go. There, it's much better. A reissuing of Ghost of the Machine is coming out November 4th, I believe. These reissues have been sitting around for a while, but you're finally getting them out. Is that right?
Yes. We're going through a phase right now of adjustment where we have been very tight-fisted about unreleased material, demos and such. Mm-hmm. But I have always thought as a fan, and I first discovered this with the Beatles, when I discovered three versions of their first single, one with Pete Best, their original drummer, one with Ringo, and one with the session guy, which is the one we're all familiar with. Wasn't Ringo, it was the session guy. Mm-hmm. And hearing these three versions in their imperfect versions made me love the work even more and respect them. It didn't diminish anything for me. And that was kind of a breakthrough. And then when there's that big documentary of the Beatles where we saw them in their, you know, the Beatles in their underpants, mm-hmm. you know, figuring it out. And, you know, like it enhanced the whole, I love the Beatles more now. I'm not a big Beatles fan, but I respect them enormously and like all their music, but I was never, you know, a Beatle fan necessarily, mm-hmm. but much more so as a result of this look behind the curtains. Now, that's affecting our police thinking. If it's okay for the Beatles, goddammit, who the hell do we think we are that it's not good enough for us? And so we're kind of coming around to, and I've just got yesterday a whole tranche of all my demos from 1975, 76, 77. I found a track with my Clark Kent songs with Sting singing my damn Clark Kent songs, which you know, him singing my dumb lyrics. You know, I'd completely forgotten about that. I'm all for those kind of releases. The record company's all for it, but we're just getting around to getting all three band members to sign off on that policy or not. Because once we open that floodgate, there's all kinds of cool stuff in there.
And it, with Ghost of the Machine, is it true that the record company wanted Omega Man to be the first single, but Sting vetoed that? Is that true?
No, I don't think that's true.
All right. I like reading through these things and getting the record straight as to what's true and what's not true.
Well, no, that was a good song. Andy wrote a lot of good songs that I, in hindsight, think could have been better. There's one of them, which I think Andy sang. If Sting had sung it, it would have been a hit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that artistic solipsism is not one of the more endearing features of our great songwriter. He has many other features that totally make up for that. But he didn't quite throw the same energy into songs that he didn't write. He's allowed to do that. Screw it. He earned his keep.
In the 4 billion covers of Every Breath You Take, do you have a favorite one?
No.
None. Okay. Not in general. And also, Jay, what I like that we'll interview of him, because he has, I think, a 16 or 17-year-old daughter. He loves Kanye West. You love Kendrick Lamar. And you stay on top of current music, which is pretty interesting.
Not anymore.
Okay. Fair enough.
Because my 16-year-old has now graduated from college. She's a killer on Wall Street.
And
I don't drive her to school every morning, so I don't get any exposure at all to what's happening.
That'll do it. That'll change your life right there.
So I'm totally out of touch. I have no idea what's going on out there. I guess that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, when we for the Foo Fighters thing, there are all these young stars there. And I'm thinking anybody, you know, with all their funny looking styles and everything, young musicians are much more stylish than us old farts. And to me, I'm thinking everybody under 40, I thought, is that Oasis? And then somebody says, oh, by the way, the guys in Oasis are like over 50. Oh, okay. But they were all these bands I never heard of, kind of cool looking. And on stage, oh, okay, that's great. You know, Viva La, you know, Up with the Young.
Right. Fair enough. And now, a couple of days from now, you're doing Police Deranged for Orchestra, which is orchestral reworkings of all the Police songs. There's a one-off in, I think it's in LA, but is that something you're going to be doing over and over again?
Oh, I've done like 14, 15 shows of that across America with orchestras across the land. I just got back from doing it in Europe, Hungary, Poland, Holland. It's a very fun show because it's songs you know and love with in an environment that is new for a lot of rock fans, the symphony orchestra. Man, it is a magnificent, fascinating musical experience to hear a full-on orchestra blazing away. And if they hit the chorus of Roxanne while they're at it, folks like that. So
there was a time when that was big. Scorpions put out a full orchestral record. Aerosmith did it. Metallica did it. There was a time in the early 2000s where that was like a hot thing to do.
Well, I have a slight advantage over those other ones. They would have to hire somebody
to do it
for them. And with the best intentions in the world, you know, when you're taking a Metallica song and orchestrating it, when Michael Kamen did these, and he actually did really good arrangements, by the way, but he's restrained by respect for his client who hire him to do that. Mm-hmm. You don't want to trash all their stuff. And so it's not that different from what, you know, from the Metallica version.
Right.
My derangements of the Police are all fucked up. They weren't broke, so I went in there and fixed them good.
Fixed them anyway.
And I did that with the impunity of being both the client and the arranger. And so I was able to, and actually I messed them all up for another reason, which was to score this movie that I made out of the Super 8 footage that I shot, yada, yada. For which I had to carve up Police music. Once I got the scalpel out, I just went into an orgy of finding guitar solos that, you know, were never on the record, finding improvisations we did on stage, all kinds of cool stuff. And I worked them in. And then I take the lyric from this song, put it with that song, taking all kinds of liberties that no hired gun would dare to take.
All right, before we go to the first, guys, anything else? Or should I move it to the first?
Just move it to the first.
Yeah. Okay.
The first time ever I saw concert, did drugs, had sex.
All right, the name of the show is the SDR Show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Show. We've asked every guest this since the dawn of time, their first experience with sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We start with rock and roll. We just mean the first concert you ever went to on your own volition, one you wanted to go see.
Jimi Hendrix.
Oh,
the Savile Theater, on Shaftesbury Avenue, London. And it was the first professional band I saw because I just arrived from Beirut, where the only bands I ever saw were my buddies in high school. It blew my mind. I was disappointed by the sound because I hadn't heard amplified drums, which sounded like crap back in those days. But I was just blown away to be there in the presence of Jimmy.
How old were you at that point?
I would have been 16, maybe 15, 16. You know, humans are like ducks. When a duck comes out of its egg shell, the first warm body, that's mama.
Right.
And for humans, when you hit 16 and the, you know, the hormones start to rage, the first blazing rock star you see, that's daddy. And for me, it was Jimi Hendrix. Absolutely, still unto this day, gets me where I live.
Did you ever get to actually meet him or no?
No. No. I once was in the presence of Mitch Mitchell in a music store. Mm-hmm. And he was just right over there, 20 feet away. And I'm going, but no, I never got to meet any of them.
And now the first drug you ever did after weed, unless weed wasn't your first drug.
Acid, I guess.
Did you love it? How old were you?
I was a freshman in college. This was an American college in Buckinghamshire, England. It had a campus in England. And the reason I was there was because I was 18 and draftable unless I stayed out of America. Mm-hmm. It was legal, fully legal. Draft Board 100 had a quota of zero. And the night I was elected social secretary, the guy who puts on concerts, was the night somebody said, "Here, try this." And I dropped some acid. And then Stanford University also had a campus right next door in the Cliveden estate, these two country estates with American colleges in them next door. Let's go over to Stanford. So we went over there and I met them with like tentacles coming out of my ears and elephants swinging from the chandeliers to meet my counterpart at Stanford, which was a much crustier college than mine. And I wonder what that person thought of meeting the representative from the college next door who was like speaking in tongues.
Now, what about the first time you had sex?
I'm not sure what it was, but it was coincided with the first night I played a show at the age of 12, which is about 3-4 years before puberty, playing the American Embassy Beach Club in Kaldi, Beirut. And Janet McRoberts, who was like 15, all that took me down the beach, and it's all kind of a fog what happened. But I think I scored.
we'll consider that a yes for sure. That's really hilarious. All right. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. You could follow him at Stuart_Copeland on Instagram, stuartcopeland.net. And, you can follow us, the Stu Daddy, of course, on TikTok as well. You also put up a lot of cool videos on TikTok. I give you credit answering fan questions and drumming classes and stuff on TikTok. Pretty cool.
Well, not so much classes. I just bang stuff.
We have drumming. What people ask you questions about how to do something, and it's just cool to see. I find it fascinating. Anything else you want to plug before we go around the room?
No, I think, we got it plugged. I'm playing a show in Seattle, another one in Cedar Falls next week. See you all there.
Jay, your plugs?
BigJComedy.com for all my dates. Bonfire, Legion of Skanks.
Josh?
That's really impressive. That just completely lit me right up there, man. gosh, your laconic delivery there just sets the world on fire.
JoshAdamMyers.com for all tickets. At Josh Adam Myers on all social media. Listen to Himbo's podcast on the Bonfire Network and the 500 on Spotify.
Fair enough.
And see, that's how you sell shit.
Thanks, man.
That's fair.
Follow me everywhere at I Am Ralph Sutton. My other podcast on health and wellness called The Good Sugar Podcast comes out every Monday. And we're opening up our first location, I think, in the end of October on the corner of 3rd Avenue and 69th Street. We end every time with a song. We'll let you pick, Mr. Copeland. Do you want it to be a police song? Do you want it to be a solo song?
Let's do some Rage.
Some Rage Against the Machine. All right, pick one.
Oh, I don't know what any of them are called. I don't read liner notes. I don't listen to lyrics. You pick one.
Josh, you have a favorite Rage song? You want all 5 nights?
Fistful of Steel. They played it on the Friday show. It's a deep cut. Deep cut, but really good.
All right. It was a fistful of steel. And let's honestly, thank you so much for coming on the show, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you, sir.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.